From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Don't put off till tomorrow,
yeah,
what you can do today. Don't leave things half finished.
That's all we've done on that.
Stop procrastinating, fool. Stop living in a rut. Go get something done right now, or do I have to kick your butt?
Procrastination is not being able to get started. It's reading a book.
It's sharpening your pencil.
I'll get a fresh start tomorrow, and it's not due till Wednesday, so I'll have all of Tuesday unless something should happen. Why does this always happen? I should be outside playing, getting fresh air and sunshine. I work best under pressure, and there'll be lots of pressure if I wait till tomorrow. I should start writing now, but if I...
Always putting things off. Procrastination, it's called.
Yeah, I know.
Do tomorrow. And remember, class, work hard and no goofing off.
Goofing off. Goofing off.
I'm goofing off.
Well, I guess that means I can't put it off any longer. Today, we look at procrastination, alias the thief of time. 95% of us put things off, and if you don't think you're part of that 95%, chances are you're just putting off admitting you're a procrastinator. So whether you're the kind of person who occasionally puts off writing a letter, or a diehard procrastinator with a basement full of unfinished projects, we'll supply some insight this hour. Exploring Procrastination, Stories of Personal Experiences, and the Philosophy Behind the Thief of Time. But first, Pierce Steele. He describes himself as a semi-reformed procrastinator, an authority on the science of motivation who teaches at the University of Calgary. Steele's the author of The Procrastination Equation, How to Stop Putting Things Off and Start Getting Stuff Done. He says, that's not always as easy as it sounds.
People fiercely defend their procrastination. They argue vehemently that I'm a procrastinator, it works for me. But strict definition, you're putting off, you have to expect to be worse off. You're putting off despite thinking that you should have started earlier by your own standards. So it's not scheduling, it's not prioritizing. Not everything can happen beforehand. Some things have to happen later. But it's doing the things later that you thought you should do now.
So procrastination, everybody has been subject to it at some time or another. I never believe anybody who says that they've never put off doing what they know they ought to do. But is it really a big problem?
Oh, yeah. It's a huge problem. For example, colorectal cancer is probably one of the biggest killers. And the reason why isn't because it's not treatable if caught early. It's just to diagnose it, you need a colonoscopy, and it's kind of humiliating and it's kind of embarrassing. So people would rather put off dying of embarrassment now and risk dying of colorectal cancer later. So that's the other end. And actually in the book, that's actually exactly what happened to my stepmother. Oh. She put it off, and by the time they diagnosed it, it was too late. So you can put off dealing with your finances, a poor marriage. Can you imagine in your life, what's the most important thing for you that if you put off, it would be disastrous? Somebody else out there is putting that off.
Wow. You're right, of course. There are things that we all know we should do and we put off. We don't think it's going to matter to us. And that just shows that we are not as wise as we thought we were.
No. In fact, actually recognizing that we are fallible, recognizing that we're not motivationally perfect, that we have lapses in willpower, and that we don't always make the right decisions, allows us to do something about it. In fact, the people who believe their actually willpower is perfect are the ones actually most likely to get into trouble.
Well, I was going to ask you if there is a personality type that is most likely to suffer from procrastination. Is there a kind of person who is more likely to put things off than others?
Well, in the book, I provide a diagnosis and help to identify what type you are, because there's actually three major causes of procrastination, contributing factors. And in fact, you can put them all together in that neat equation. That's why it's called the procrastination equation. The biggest one of those three is impulsiveness. You know, inability to delay gratification. It's wanting it all now. You can be very spontaneous. You're maybe probably a little bit more fun. And you can take advantage of the opportunity as it kind of leaps upon you. But typically, it's unfortunately really kind of cuts two ways, a bad side effect. It's when vices provide their pleasures more readily than virtues, then the ones most impulsive would be also be the most corruptible. And this is really what causes procrastination, is that we have these long-term but delayed goals, things that are going to provide the rewards, but in the future, like, you know, getting a degree, exercising, quitting smoking. On the other hand, we have all these temptations that pull us away from these long-term goals. For example, you know, Facebook, social media. I mean, I talk about the internet nowadays, and this is why you see a fivefold increase in procrastination over the last 30 years, is that we're all trying to work where there's a casino, a strip club, and a games room in virtual terms.
Well, and even small things, I have to say, one of the things that struck me most when I was starting your book was the suggestion you turn off the notification that you've got an email. There's something about sitting in your office when that little beep goes off that it's almost impossible to ignore. And maybe you want to.
And acknowledging that you're going to have difficulty ignoring your email, that your will is not perfect, allows you to do something ahead of time to actually do something about it. So by turning that off, actually, you get about a 10% pop in productivity each day. There's other things you want to do. People say, well, I can't work flat out. I need to actually have little breaks. I said, yeah, little breaks. But so often, how often you said, I'm just going to watch TV for 15 minutes, and now they're still there 2 hours later. One way of doing this is actually having an alternate logon. So you have a Dr. Jekyll and a Mr. Hyde personality. When you want to take a break, log off your Dr. Jekyll and then go to your Mr. Hyde and make sure Mr. Hyde looks different. It has a different background, a different feel to it. And you'll find out that you actually won't feel that you need to take breaks as often. And then when you're on your Dr. Jekyll personality, you won't be distracted as easy as you once were.
Yeah. How much of this is hardwired into us? How much are we all sort of built to put things off?
There's been actually a few kind of genetic twin studies. It's really great methodology, twins raised together and raised apart. You can tease out the exact amount of genetic source of any of all these personality traits. It's about 50%. So half you, half environment. That still leaves a lot. It's kind of like getting a poker hand. You know, a few cards are dealt with you and a few can choose. You know, it can make a really big difference. So this is why I don't think you can eliminate it entirely, but you certainly can manage it. There's a lot of things that have genetic origins, like diabetes. Some people are more susceptible to diabetes. But, you know, with proper diet and exercise, you can actually control it. And the same thing with procrastination. Just because it has a genetic origin doesn't mean there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, tell me a little bit about the genetic origin of procrastination. I'm not sure that I understand. Are we literally built to create this struggle?
Oh, all of us, yes. All of us to one degree or another. Like height is genetic in origin, but some are small and some are tall. Same thing with procrastination. It's really baked into our brain's neurobiology at a fundamental level. It's because we have not one decision-making system built into us, but two. We have a limbic system, and this is our emotional part of our brain, which responds to immediate concerns and concrete sights and sounds and smells and tastes. Then we have this other, more recently developed neocortex, literally new bark, the prefrontal cortex, and this is often called the executive function. This is where all your long-term kind of plans and really where the seat of willpower happens. So we make long-term plans. You know, I want to diet. I want to kind of go for that promotion in the prefrontal cortex. But when tomorrow comes, we actually have to enact it. You get these cravings to do otherwise, and that's the limbic, the emotional response. So you have people having this conflict. You know, you want to eat that cake, but you wish you didn't want it. And really, procrastination occurs because even though you know you should be doing this and you wish you had the motivation, you only really get going when both systems are finally saying go. And that only happens just before the deadline.
Another aspect of procrastination is that it doesn't always affect only you. It often has an effect on other people.
That's right, exactly. Just to go back, beginning of the written word, I mean, there's Egyptian hieroglyphs chiseled into stone about procrastination. So it is part of the human condition. It's just gotten worse because of the environment. But yes, it affects those around you.
Yeah.
I mean, every time you actually, some people say, well, can I depend upon you to do this? But they always end up putting it off to later. They might have sincere intentions to help. They might really say they are going to kind of finish that report, but temptation gets in the way. We've looked at it as a whole, and of course, unsurprisingly, procrastinators tend to be less wealthy, less healthy, and less happy. I mean, with 70% of people still putting off their flossing, well, it's going to lead to tooth decay. But then you kind of actually go into more extreme ones, and I already talked about getting your colonoscopy, and there's all the kind of range in between there, but also dealing with your finances.
Yeah.
Rates are going to go up. Do you have your mortgage locked in? Do you have a big revolving balance in your credit card? And these cause anxiety. And they said, oh, I don't want to deal with it. I'm going to put it off. Even the discussion of it causes people to actually kind of want to not deal with it.
But people are interested in this. I mean, you had a survey that you did. I don't know whether it was online or not. I guess it was. It was on your website.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
And something like 4,000 people took your survey?
Oh, no. Actually, well, that's just for one study. It's closer to actually about 40,000 in right now. But yes, we have a lot of interested people. We actually did one about the demographic of the typical procrastinator. Tend to be young, of course, because we already talked about that. Actually, females procrastinate a little less than males. We actually did a little study, and we found it actually gives them a noticeable advantage in the workplace. So you actually see that women have higher levels of self-control and they procrastinate less. Explains the rise in the workforce because jobs require that. We also see that the procrastinators tend to put off their job hunt a little bit more, so they're more likely to be underemployed or unemployed. And we also did a national level one. This is a kind of a funny little quirky thing. I'm not sure if people are feeding into their cultural stereotype when they responded to this, because this nation does have a saying, we don't have anything as urgent as mañana in Ireland. The Irish actually topped up in terms of their admitted level of procrastination.
What other kinds of questions did you ask in the survey?
Well, one, for example, re-exploring once again the procrastination perfectionism myth. Most resources that have been around for the last, 30, 40 years still kind of believe that the reason why procrastination comes around is because you're a perfectionist. When actually all the research, every single top major expert in perfectionism said, no, it's not. It's actually the opposite way around. Perfectionists actually procrastinate a little less, not a little bit more. However, because they're perfectionists, they do feel worse about it, and they're more likely to go and get clinical help. But actually being a perfectionist actually is something that reduces your level of procrastination.
Hmm. I do have one last question, which I think you may have answered, but I'm going to ask it again anyway. Do you think there's any positive side to procrastination?
In being impulsive, the underlying technique and the source of it, yes. But the actual behavior, only by accident. If you thought it was a good idea to put it off, it wasn't procrastination to begin with.
Piers Steele teaches in the business school at the University of Calgary, and he's the author of The Procrastination Equation, How to Stop Putting Things Off and Start Getting Stuff Done. You can take his procrastination quiz to find out just how big a procrastinator you are. You'll find a link on our website at ttbook.org. There's a link to our Facebook page there, too. And, if you take that quiz, let us know how you did. Who knows? Maybe we have the makings of the next great reality TV show here, American Procrastinator. Patricia Pearson is an award-winning Canadian novelist and journalist. Her books include A Brief History of Anxiety, Yours and Mine. Pearson's also a procrastinator.
The other day, my husband was cleaning the fridge when he beckoned me to stop watching an all-new episode of Pick a Puppy on the Learning Channel and to come into the kitchen instead. Patricia, he said with a certain good-natured vexation, could you somehow devise a more rational approach to leftovers before I file for divorce? Ah, I peered at the shelves in our Frigidaire. There was a recycled yogurt cup housing one-third of a fish stick from the previous night's dinner. Beside it, some Tupperware containing approximately 2 tablespoons of soup. Next to that, a jar with a 1-inch square strip of steak leaning tiredly against a string bean. And on the shelf above, a sip's worth of milk in a glass. The trouble I have here has to do with endings. In particular, I don't like to finish the last bite of food on my plate, and I put it off by saving these bites for some unspecified time in the future when I might wish to have a lick of chicken noodle soup or a dried-out morsel of haddock. Our fridge looks like a picnic hamper for squirrels, my husband said. And of course, the food does tend to become that as each tidbit eventually withers from my ambivalent neglect and gets transferred to the garbage. It is an unusual form of procrastination, I suppose, this tendency to put off consuming the entirety of dinner. But on some level, it's an act of resistance, I think, to living in a culture of haste and consumption. Hurry to the latest version of iTunes and the newest rendition of smartphones and the up-to-the-momentous dining experience. Buy and acquire and nibble and gnaw and rush about at rodent speed. Don't dither, get on with it, seize the day, move your unacceptably slowed-down butt along. He who hesitates is lost. Procrastination has fallen into ill repute, and I don't like it. Consider me counter-suggestive. Sometimes I think I would have been a more contented citizen of ancient Egypt, except for the part where one dies of sepsis at the age of 20 and has to spend eternity with a mummified cat, but otherwise, the pace was much more agreeable. For 3,000 years, it didn't occur to anyone in ancient Egypt to change their hairstyle. Century upon century went by, with everyone appearing to walk sideways along walls in the same sort of outfit, carrying similar stuff while sporting chin-length bobs. Everybody worshipped the same divine beings, decade after decade. 3 millennia, and still Anubis the jackal-headed god lording it over the temple. What was a generation gap in ancient Egypt? One generation of women preferred dyeing their hands with henna, and the next generation preferred dyeing their hands with henna, too. At some point, there was probably some seismic shift where the daughters rebelled and decided to use pomegranate juice, but then everyone settled back down to henna. We wouldn't know about it because the scribes took 4 months to carve out a single line of hieroglyphics, what with all their procrastinatory naps, and they had lots to note down about the afterlife before they got to fashion skirmishes and skin dye. Were they wasteful and hurried in the Nile Delta of 2000 BCE? I think not. Where innovation was concerned, they managed to procrastinate pretty much into infinity. And why is that a bad thing? There's no virtue in quicksilver change, and thus no inherent virtue in accomplishing everything now. Today. Because what we are being asked to accomplish is suspect, the very idea of procrastination becomes problematic. All right, I tell my husband, having thought about it aloud on public radio, I've decided to modify my approach to leftovers. I will henceforth eat my food, but refuse to buy an iPad or a new pair of shoes, and I will reserve some time each day for deep contemplative thought.
Patricia Pearson's the author of A Brief History of Anxiety, yours and mine. How do you deal with procrastination? Have you found a solution that works? If you have any thoughts on the subject, you can send us email through our website, ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Don't put it off. Coming up, we'll look at procrastination through the lens of philosophy, as we continue this hour on The Thief of Time. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin System eCampus, providing access to online degree programs and certificates offered by the 26 campuses of the UW system. Information is at ecampus.wisconsin.edu.
Is procrastination just a bad habit? Or is it something worse, like a vice. Now, maybe it's not up there with coveting your neighbor's wife or cheating on your income tax, but maybe it's not so innocent either. Jennifer Baker is a philosopher at the College of Charleston and the author of a recent essay called Procrastination as Vice. Steve Paulson wondered why a philosopher would be interested in procrastination.
As an ethicist, what I find so philosophically important about procrastination is how we categorize it in terms of behavior. So is it good or bad behavior? What type of bad behavior is it? Is it a vice or not? Is really my focus. But I think testing vice, testing our account of vice through its application on procrastination just reveals all sorts of things about human nature.
So what does it mean to think about procrastination as vice?
Well, we have to make some decisions. So if you want to consider procrastination to be a vice, then you're going to be taking a non-Aristotelian approach to procrastination. And you're going to be suggesting it's something that can be overcome. And then you have to make some decisions. Is it something that can be overcome through force of will? I think that's really implausible, but a Kantian might say that. Or is it something that can be overcome through choosing better activities? Or is it something that can be overcome through having a more realistic self-image?
Now, getting back to Aristotle, he did not see procrastination as vice, right?
That's what I argue. He has this very nuanced account of choice, and he would rule it out as a vice because it's not something we choose. Nobody wants to be a procrastinator. Nobody makes that decision. On the other hand, people make decisions to have vices all the time. Today, we say vice, and I almost think of it as a positive thing, like, you know, roguish qualities or something. I mean vice in the really old-fashioned sense, the unfun stuff. Vice, for Aristotle, is going to have to be something that's chosen. So someone who chooses to be lazy, for example, or a real slacker throughout life, they've made a choice. And if you ask them about it, they'll have a rationale, right? I don't think I should have to do work. I don't like working, right? They'll have all these things to say about their choice. But procrastination isn't like that. We don't intend to become a procrastinator, and procrastinators don't have great things to say about it.
So if Aristotle did not see procrastination as vice, how did he see it?
He saw it as completely typical of human nature. So even if we don't happen to be a procrastinator, or as seems kind of common, we aren't procrastinators anymore now that we've graduated from college, we still are going to have the same problems procrastinators have. So researchers have found there's not one type of procrastination. There are different types of procrastination. Some people seem to be really into the thrill of getting the stuff done at the last minute. So they get a kind of pleasure from that. Some people really like keeping their options open, so they just kind of can't make a decision about what course of action to take. And then some procrastinators seem to have a real fear of being judged by their work, so they just want to put off that work. They're perfectionistic, and so they're never going to be comfortable with what they produce or the idea that it could be looked at by others. But these things, being too into pleasure, being incapable of thinking clearly about a course of action, being way too susceptible to other people's opinions, those are things that put all of us in peril. Those are our challenges as humans. So whether we procrastinate or not, those are the challenges we face.
Now, isn't there another philosophical tradition to thinking about procrastination, again, going back to the ancient Greeks, that perhaps sees it as not such an awful thing? I mean, maybe there are good reasons why people procrastinate.
Yeah, it's an interesting and complex sign, I think the Epicureans and the Stoics would say. So the Epicureans, if you are writing and you find it really difficult to make deadlines, they'd just laugh at you for your interest in writing. You know, why are you doing this? This isn't for you. You're not cut out for this, right? Some people write every day and almost do so compulsively. Let them be writers, right? You're just interested in self-torture for some reason. So they would not take the procrastinating in writing seriously. That's not something you have to fix. But they would take it as a serious sign you need to change your life. They also think there's a type of procrastination that people do. It's kind of similar to the classic Christian worries about procrastination, and it's procrastination on coming to terms with mortality. So there are some Epicurean lines, you know, all of life is lost through procrastination. Now, they don't mean finish your novel. They mean stop putting off thinking about life.
And then what about the Stoics?
The Stoics have a slightly different account than the Epicureans when it comes to procrastination, and they're going to zone in on your self-image. And they think the big mistake we make is to think the wrong things about ourselves. So this makes procrastination kind of embarrassing. A lot of procrastination is done because we have the wrong kind of self-image. We think we are better than other people. We think our work is supposed to be better. Our work matters more than other people's work. If we just adjusted our self-image and understood that our paper is going to be as middling as the other papers, right? Or if we just were honest and, you know, called our editor and said, I have no thoughts on this topic whatsoever, and I've written a paragraph, right? If we just expose ourselves, we'd have a more realistic self-image. These grandiose ideas we have about our greatness really get in the way of our lives in general, the Stoics think.
Sounds like the defeatist view of procrastination, but maybe it would make a lot of us happier. You know, we wouldn't be sort of tortured by self-doubt.
I tried, and it makes me happier. I recommend it to students.
You're not serious, though. I mean, you're not
I'm serious.
Wait, you are? Isn't the job of the professor to make sure the students do their work and on time?
No, I try and tease them. They get so panicky about their grades, and I try and figure out why they think they will be destroyed by failing a test. You know, why can't they take it? If you earned an F, you have an F. Move on. But they don't see it that way.
Now, the whole business of dealing with deadlines would seem to be paramount in this discussion of procrastination. And for some people, deadlines are what makes them get through life. I mean, without deadlines, right, they'd fall apart. And other people sort of put things off, and then, you know, they're driven to distraction with their stress. The student's life is full of deadlines.
Right.
And yet you're suggesting, it sounds like, don't sweat it too much.
Well, if they are waiting till a deadline to study for, you know, right before the test or right before the paper's due to write the paper, they will do suboptimal work, right? But some of that is poor design, I think, on the part of professors, right? We know that happens. So we should assign papers in tiers, they call it. We should assign drafts. They should have to turn in drafts throughout the semester to keep them from working on a paper the night before it's due. I give a lot of midterms because I don't want my students to wait and try and cram philosophy, which I think is particularly tragic. So I give a lot of midterms to kind of fight off that kind of natural reaction to having an assignment you aren't quite ready for.
So your strategy is basically to create conditions where people can't really procrastinate.
Yeah. Now, that's an Aristotelian strategy, because I'm not accusing the students, as I do that, of having the wrong self-image or of having the wrong values in life. But Aristotle would suggest that we all need that type of help.
But it also sounds like procrastination, if we're really honest with ourselves, is a vehicle for personal change. I mean, if we really think about this and think about what makes us unhappy and how we constantly feel bad about not doing the stuff we think we should do, maybe we really need to rethink what our lives are all about.
Right. Very Stoic and Epicurean. That's how they would use procrastination, for sure.
Do you think many people think that way today?
No, I don't. They should. I mean, part of it is that there hasn't been a lot of attention to procrastination. It still seems kind of like a funny subject or a side topic. And so psychologists are, you know, they're doing more and more work on it. So that's great. Maybe it'll get more attention that way. But also, people are very ashamed about their procrastination. So it's not even something we discuss so much. Even if we discussed it more and admitted more to it, I have a feeling these insights would occur to us.
Jennifer Baker is a philosophy professor and the author of the essay Procrastination as Vice. It's from The Thief of Time, Philosophical Essays on Procrastination. She spoke with Steve Paulson. We go to another philosopher next, Chrysoula Andreo from the University of Utah. She co-edited The Thief of Time and contributed her own essay called Coping with Procrastination. She outlined a number of strategies for estrangeants, including one borrowed from psychology, an implementation intention.
the idea of an implementation intention is, instead of having a vague goal, like I will lose weight or I will get into better shape, you come up with a way of implementing that in a kind of specific plan. And so you come up with a plan that may be something like, okay, on Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, I will walk home from work. That's sort of not just a, it's not a vague goal. It actually gives you a way of implementing what you want to do.
So you're sort of breaking it down into little baby steps, and your goal is no longer the great big thing. Down the line, it's very specific. My goal is to exercise 5 days a week or 3 days a week or to, you know, to only have dessert on Saturdays.
Yeah, so the two features are, it's not vague, it's specific, and also, it, like you said, it kind of breaks it down into a certain series of steps, so it's not just something in the distance where there's no particular thing that you need to be doing at any particular time to achieve it. It's like, I want this vague goal, this big thing, and here's the way I'm going to achieve it. And once you've set out an implementation, there is a sense in which it's not vague anymore. If the way you're planning on doing it is this way, and yet you're not sticking to that, there is a psychological sort of dissonance or a kind of problem that occurs there. And it actually does motivate people. It does make a difference.
Well, my experience as a lifelong procrastinator, frankly, is that I'm incredibly wily at overcoming all sorts of strategies. So what are the negative consequences to this particular strategy?
In this case, actually, one of the problems with the strategy is not so much that you're able to find exceptions, although that's a problem with some strategies, that you kind of look for creative ways of kind of getting out of the, it wasn't supposed to apply in this type of circumstance, in this type of circumstance, I can deviate in this way. In this case, one of the problems is actually, because it's so specific and clearly defined, if you do lapse, it often reinforces the feeling that you're not capable of achieving this goal. So it lowers your feeling of efficacy. And one lapse makes it more likely that you'll actually just give up altogether. So there's the idea that a bright line is good because it helps kind of guide you and be more specific. But if you lapse, it's more easy to just say, oh, forget it, this is too hard, there's no way. And there is some studies in relation to addiction that suggest that, you know, if you have a first lapse, oftentimes you'll just take that kind of resigned attitude of like, oh, forget it, this is just too hard.
Right, that one drink and you decide, well, that's it, I might as well have the whole bottle.
Right, exactly. Because it just sort of reinforces the idea, like, I don't really have the self-control to achieve this goal.
Now, another thing people do is set it up so that there are costs to procrastinating. I can tell you from personal experience, there are an awful lot of journalists who would never write a word if it weren't for their editor's deadlines. That's actually a fairly effective strategy, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is effective for a lot of things. But there are certain areas in your life where external constraints aren't as easy to implement, either because they kind of invade your privacy too much, or there are no kind of socially available kind of prefabricated devices that you could just rely on. So you have to kind of construct a device yourself, you know, somehow get other people involved in monitoring you and stuff.
Oh, this is the thing. If you want to take up running, do it with a friend. When your friend is pounding on your door at 6 a.m, you're going to go ahead and put on your running shoes.
Oh, yeah. And then in that case, your friend really is your best friend because they're a cheap pre-commitment device. If they are there at 6 a.m. pounding on your door, great. That's an external incentive that's kind of available to you. No massive financial cost or invasion of privacy. So I would say in that context, you would gravitate towards something like that and it would probably work quite well. I mean, some people might object that too much reliance on external kind of incentives is actually going to kind of weaken your self-control. And so when that you actually need it in some cases, you haven't sort of strengthened it like a muscle where you can actually employ it. You're relying too much on external constraints. But I would say that in some areas of your life, they're just so convenient and so such a reasonable solution. The cost is not too great. They're readily accessible that it does make sense to use those.
Another strategy you tend to see suggested is, well, it's kind of a variation on how we potty train children. You set up your own system of rewards. So something, you know, more sophisticated than a sticker chart, but along the same lines. Does that work?
Yeah. Part of the reason I think that can work, and that's the strategy I call leveraging control. And that's the strategy that I discuss because I don't think it's been as extensively studied in the literature on procrastination. But at least with respect to adults, I think there is some reason to believe it's not so much that either you're a procrastinator or not, or either you have good self-control or you have poor self-control. It's actually something that varies by domain in your life and by area. And so you can have a lot of, as a professor, you're used to hearing other professors say and sometimes complaining yourself, oh, these students are such procrastinators. They know they need to do this, but they always just put it off till the last minute. And then you find out sometimes, well, in some cases, they're not procrastinators at all. They're, you know, really disciplined when it comes to their weight training regimen or something else. And I think that's true for all of us, is that there are certain areas in our lives that either through habit or for some other reason, we've cultivated more self-control. And I think we can use those areas to help us gain self-control in other areas by something like a reward system. So if I have a lot of self-control when it comes to, let's say, spending money, I can use that to reward myself for, let's say, sticking to an exercise program. And I know that I will not reward myself unless I've earned it, because I have a lot of self-control with respect to that area of my life. And so can add a little bit of extra incentive. And sometimes a little bit of extra incentive is all you need, because if procrastination sometimes functions as a free rider problem, where part of the reason you put off the thing is because you think it's negligible, it's not going to have a big impact one way or the other. Once you add a non-negligible impact that you yourself are going to enforce, you might be more motivated to stick with the original plan that you came up with. It might add just enough kind of impact to motivate you.
So explain how this works in practice. We were talking about exercising, for instance. So how would you use a leveraged control strategy to make yourself stick to your exercise routine?
As I said, you have to have an area of where you have decent self-control. So let's say the decent self-control is in the area of spending or spending on treats or something like that. You might tell yourself, okay, only if I exercise 3 times a week or walk home from work these 3 days will I have earned the right to go out for a really nice dinner on Friday night. And I know, again, if I have a lot of self-control when it comes to spending money, I know that I will, you know, enforce that. I really will not provide with myself with the reward unless I have done the exercise.
Boy, this sounds really tricky, though, because self-control, I guess it's a strategy that's entirely dependent on self-control, which seems like exactly what the procrastinator has trouble with. So if somebody is already avoiding their exercise program, wouldn't they also simply be likely to avoid their penalty?
Well, that's why the strategy depends crucially on the idea that self-control varies from domain to domain. So yes, the strategy would be totally puzzling if you could just say of people, oh, this person's a procrastinator or this person has poor self-control. But if things are more subtle than that, they have a lot of self-control in some areas and poor self-control in others, then it is actually possible for them to, as I said, leverage their control from one area into another. I mean, the one reason I think the strategy has just seemed kind of puzzling or paradoxical, like it couldn't be true. But if you recognize that, you know, a problem with self-control doesn't have to be a global problem, you know, in every aspect of your life, then it's no longer puzzling. It is a possibility for you yourself to kind of intervene via your self-control in another domain.
Krisula Andreu is the co-editor of and a contributor to The Thief of Time, Philosophical Essays on Procrastination. She spoke with Enstrain Champs. Have you found effective ways to put off procrastinating? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, more thoughts for people who have trouble getting things done. A Procrastinator's Guide to Life, next. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Jeff Dyer's book, Out of Sheer Rage, is, I think, probably the single best book I know about the experience of procrastination.
That's Mark Kingwell. And well, you know, not to procrastinate or anything. Before we meet him, here's an excerpt from that book he likes. I had decided years earlier that I would one day write a book about D.H. Lawrence, homage to the writer who had made me want to become a writer. It was a cherished ambition, and as part of my preparation for realizing this cherished ambition, I had avoided reading anything by Lawrence, so that at some point in the future I could go back to him, if not afresh, then at least not rock stale. I didn't want to go back to him passively. Didn't want to pick up a copy of Sons and Lovers aimlessly to pass the time. I wanted to read him with a purpose. Then, after years of avoiding Lawrence, I moved into the phase of what might be termed pre-preparation. I visited Eastwood, his birthplace. I read biographies. I amassed a hoard of photographs, which I kept in a once-new document wallet, blue, on which I had written DHL photos in determined black ink. I even built up an impressive stack of notes with Lawrence vaguely in mind. But these notes, it is obvious to me now, actually served not to prepare for and facilitate the writing of a book about Lawrence, but to defer and postpone doing so. Now, there's nothing unusual about this. All over the world, people are taking notes as a way of postponing, putting off, and standing in for. My case was more extreme, for not only was taking notes about Lawrence a way of putting off writing a study of, and homage to, the writer who had made me want to become a writer, but this study I was putting off writing was itself a way of putting off and postponing another book. It's an excerpt from Out of Sheer Rage, Wrestling with D.H. Lawrence by Jeff Dyer. It's a rare author who doesn't know something about procrastination. As anyone who's ever tried to write anything knows, the temptation to avoid that blank page can be overwhelming. It's a temptation Canadian philosopher Mark Kingwell has luckily learned to overcome. He's written many books, including one called Catch and Release, Trout Fishing and the Meaning of Life. He sat down with Steve Paulson recently to talk about the chapter called Boredom, Procrastination, and Losing Your Way.
The problem with procrastination is precisely that the task you should be doing is the one you can't do. And yet, when you're in a procrastinatory bind, you're perfectly capable of doing all kinds of things, even very productive things, as long as they're the thing not that you have to do. So the idea, in a way, is to trick yourself into achieving things by doing them when you don't have to do them, instead of doing the one thing that you think you have to do. And by doing these rounds of trickery with yourself, you can actually get a lot done. And indeed, that's how I got my dissertation finished.
Hmm. So this is very different from laziness. It's not as if you don't want to do anything. It's just that you don't want to do the one thing you're supposed to be doing.
That's it exactly. And I think the best way to conceptualize this is to see it as a conflict between two different orders of desire. So you have a second order desire, which is a desire about a desire. You want to do the thing that you're supposed to do, but you have a first order desire not to do it, or anyway, you lack that first order desire to do it. And this conflict between the first and the second order is what creates the distress of procrastination. And it's precisely the bind within the psyche itself, which means that you stall on that particular task. So it really has almost nothing to do with laziness. It often looks to the world like laziness because you're not doing the thing you're supposed to be doing, but in fact it is a kind of psychic bind.
But as you say, if you can figure out how to sort of trick your own desires, you can sort of find these smaller tasks that will perhaps get you to finish the larger task.
That's one solution. The classical solution, of course, and this is rooted in really ancient philosophy of mind and philosophy of action, is to try and line up your first and second order desires so that the thing you want to do and wanting to want to do that thing are aligned and you go about your business.
You'll have to explain that. So give me an example of that.
Okay, so suppose I have a task that I'm set to do, and that is, say, cleaning the house. Because of my sense of duty and orderliness, I want to clean the house. So I have a second-order desire about that task. But what I may or may not have is the first-order desire actually to do it. That is, I may want to clean the house or not want to clean the house. Now, I can overcome not wanting to through sheer strength of will, and that's one kind of solution. I can trick myself into doing it while not doing something else. Or in the best case scenario, at least classically, I should simply have that first order desire match my second order desire. So not only do I want to clean the house, I actually want to clean the house. And here I go, getting out the vacuum.
This sounds like the kind of thing that philosophers talk about.
Well, you know, it's as old as, at least as old as Plato's dialogues, because we know in Plato's Republic, he talks about a character called Leontius, who goes outside the walls of the city and sees some corpses piled after a battle. And he can't tear his eyes away from this ghastly sight. It's maybe the first recorded instance of rubbernecking. And what he says, actually, is he denies and denounces his eyes. So he says, he turns angrily and he says, okay, take your fill of this beautiful sight, you horrible things, his eyes. So he's got a conflict there between his desire to look and his desire not to want to look. And in that particular case, his will is insufficiently strong to stop that first order desire from taking over. And that's what philosophers call weakness of the will, or akrasia. And procrastinatory states of mind are intimately related to that kind of akrasia.
Now, there are also some larger, deeper issues that come into this discussion. I want to quote a passage from your book. You write, "Procrastination most often arises from a sense that there is too much to do and hence no single aspect of the to-do worth doing. Underneath this rather antic form of action as inaction is the much more unsettling question whether anything at all is worth doing." I mean, you're really getting at the futility of existence, aren't you?
Yeah, and it's I really think this is the existential beast that's crouched in the lair of an everyday experience. The initial experience might be something on the order of you open the fridge and you say there's nothing to eat because you can't fix your desire on any particular thing, even though, of course, there are, in fact, many things to eat. And the same thing can arise in your experience of a task. Lots of things to do in any given day. In fact, most of us feel that we're overburdened with things to do. But no single one seems to catch our attention in such a way that we can get our desires behind it. And once that starts to chip away at your sense of purpose, it really does start raising these questions about, you know, all the things that we spend all of our time and energy thinking about doing and maybe even doing, which of them, if any, are worth doing at all?
Maybe there's no point to doing anything.
Well, the famous tag that procrastination is the thief of time strikes me as relevant here because so much of what we do is a function of an immersion in a temporal structure. So we make appointments, we have Blackberries and date books and schedules, and that keeps us really from thinking too deeply about whether any of those appointments are worth keeping or whether those tasks are actually worth doing. And this is what we do to get through the days. But I do think that underneath this fairly ordinary experience of procrastination, there is something really quite profound that strikes us with full existential force.
Well, it sounds like procrastination is perhaps one of the great issues for philosophers, which makes me wonder whether philosophers themselves are more likely to procrastinate, or perhaps procrastinators are more prone to become philosophers.
I think both things are true, and it relates also to experiences like boredom, which has an unexpectedly deep philosophical payoff. Most people think of procrastination as something to be disapproved of. So, and the famous inversion of that is probably De Quincey's, where he's in The Fine Art of Murder, he says, you know, something like, once you let yourself commit an act of murder, you'll soon find yourself by steps committing even more serious things like incivility and procrastination. And he knew whereof he spoke because De Quincey was one of the great procrastinators of his age and yet also tremendously prolific. And when you take those two facts into account, you see that is a portrait of a man in a certain kind of perpetual crisis. You know, he's fleeing the deep philosophical lesson of procrastination by trying to work it out through production. And in a way, he's a quintessentially modern figure. But yes, philosophers, I think, they ignore this kind of experience at their peril. And the best philosophers are the ones who take this kind of everyday experience and really start to probe it in the way that we have been doing.
Now, you suggest that actually, if you're looking for a close relative of procrastination, it's not boredom, it's actually addiction. Can you explain that connection?
All of weakness of the will, addiction, procrastination, and boredom can be conceptualized in this difference between first and second order desires. So the close kinship between addiction and procrastination is that the addict, like the procrastinator, has a problem where his first order and second order desires don't line up. In the addict's case, it's the reverse. So the addict has a first-order desire for his or her drug, but usually has a second-order desire not to have that first-order desire. So, you know, I want to do the line of coke, but I don't want that because I know it's bad. So the addict is, in a sense, in a similar kind of spiral, only with the polarity reversed, and each action of giving in to that conflict furthers his or her immersion in the addiction, just like each inaction on the case of the procrastinator perpetuates the spiral of procrastination.
Well, it also raises the question of whether there's something pleasurable about procrastination, about not doing the thing. I mean, can that, I don't know, create joy in our lives, even though we feel guilty about it?
Yeah, you know, you wish that were true. I mean, in a way, the addict is better off than the procrastinator because at least he can take the first order pleasure in the experience of the drug. Most procrastinators are racked by guilt because the external disapproval is matched by internal disapproval. And that's why it's not the same as idleness, for example. The true idler is able to say, what I'm doing now is nothing. And that's a kind of new scale of value, a new order of activity. The procrastinator is more like the slacker, the person who is aware that he should be doing something else but isn't. And that awareness colors the whole experience of not doing it, such that the procrastinator can never really take any deep pleasure in not doing the thing that he should be doing because the shouldness of that hangs over the whole experience.
So that person becomes a moral failure in a way.
Exactly. So one of the solutions that I haven't mentioned so far is simply to abandon your projects and actually be an idler. And of course, the idler never procrastinates. The idler is simply doing nothing always.
Seems the great dilemma is always, how can you be both an idler and still maintain ambition? Can you have both those things?
I think you can. I'm blessed because being a professor of philosophy in a way is one of the few professions where you get rewarded for being idle, really. I mean, you know, you're writing articles and teaching, but in some larger sense of what the world considers work, you're doing something idle. I think that's a proud banner to bear. But the idea that somehow ambition is always about achievement in measurable ways itself needs to be queried. We're here for a mortal span whose length we know not, and our ambition should really be to make the most of the time that we have, not knowing how much of it there is. And there is no time to be spent feeling shame at not doing things. You should find things that you can do, however, whatever method works for that, and enjoy doing them.
Mark Kingwell is the author of Catch and Release, Trout Fishing and the Meaning of Life. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 123A, Procrastination. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anstrain Chimps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickard. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.